getting from the arbitrage trades, but like the pools do need to be balanced. And then the question becomes how much quote unquote non-toxic flow, organic flow can we get? And those traders do pay more in swap fees than they make moving the pool. And so if you want your pools to be profitable, you need to have a lot of quote unquote non-toxic flow relative to your size.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH. Exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV, an intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%.
GM, GM, everyone. My name's Tagachi, the host of Scraping Bits. Today, I'm with the man, the myth, the legend, Doug from Ambient. How's it going?
Thanks for having me here today.
Of course. Thanks for coming on, taking the time, and I'm excited to talk as well. And just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
So yeah, my name is Doug. I'm the founder of Ambient Finance, which is a next generation DEX running on Ethereum, Scroll, Blast, and a number of other new chains coming soon.
Before we dive into Ambient, how did you really get into all of the things you're doing now? What was the progression into how you got to where you are now?
Sure. Yeah. So I spent most of my career actually in TradFi. I spent most of my career as an HFT quant trader. Started out at Citadel way back 15 years ago, was there for a while, progressed a number of smaller teams in various markets, different parts over the world, different products. And then I kind of got into crypto right during DeFi summer, was kind of read about MEV, thought it was kind of interesting, became a searcher for a bit, and then wanted to move from the kind of the trading side, actually building the DEXs that I was trading on, had a number of ideas, and that's when I started Ambient and have been on that journey ever since.
What were you doing as a searcher? How long were you doing that for?
Yeah, I spent about a year as a searcher, mostly just doing relatively simple stuff at the time. So priority gas auctions and a little bit of atomic arbitrage. The game was a lot simpler then. So before Flashbots, I kind of liked it. Then I didn't like it as much once you had PBS, to be honest.
Yeah, I get that. It was really the Dark Forest. And any chain without Flashbots equivalent is quite fun.
Yeah.
Dig more into the code and then that's how you gain the edge, I feel like.
Yeah, getting deep into the weeds of the Geth connection.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of just mess around with all the minute details and then you gain like a ton of edges and then you have fun.
Yeah.
So then how did you get into Ambient then? Like what was the pivotal moment of being like, I want to start
So it was shortly after UniV3
release
came out. Yeah, release. So I thought concentrated. Like, I mean, to be honest, like I probably would like everything was XYK, and I like cool range XYK. And like,
yeah.
To be honest, when it was that, I never really thought like, okay, AMMs can like be that useful because you always have like this deep capital inefficiency. But once you can actually concentrate liquidity on AMMs, I felt like a kind of a 0-1 moment, you know, not obviously like XYK was like a big breakthrough too, but like once you can actually concentrate liquidity, there's no like fundamental capital based reason that AMMs couldn't like compete with kind of traditional order books or other markets because you didn't have to like waste so much capital in the ranges. Right. So like, it's like, to be honest, like that kind of never occurred to me, like the whole idea of concentrating liquidity. I'm like, it was like pretty brilliant, like how it was constructed. Yeah. But then I just felt like when that came out, like, okay, the next thing is going to be like, instead of capital, the issue is going to be like toxicity and other things. If you could solve that, then you could really make AMMs actually like competitive with traditional markets. So that's kind of motivated me to start Ambient.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I super love V3 as well. It turns out like a new MEV strategy emerged from it, which was JIT. You know, just-in-time liquidity, and like all the LPs just get completely wrecked from it. That's the only caveat I see. So, you know, people with millions of dollars in, they're just sitting there thinking that they're getting a ton of fees. In reality, they're just getting wrecked, and they're actually just exit liquidity.
Yeah, we actually addressed that. So it's not like perfectly solved, but like kind of mitigated in the sense that like in Ambient, at least when you mint concentrated liquidity, there's a minimum time it has to write, right? Because like the big advantage like JIT, if you're building the block, is like you take zero risk because you can mint and you can burn. If you actually have to like let it rest for us, it's like 250 seconds You know, you still have like that advantage of getting in the swap, but you actually have to take meaningful risk on the other side, which is right, dissuades a lot of people. I don't think actually there's any really JIT activity as far as I know or mainnet. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that being said, right, like that would be like one example where to me, like the big thing with AMMs is I think like people debate like the mechanics on like versus order books, like on like where does like one end and the other begin. But like for me, like the big thing is like AMMs are cooperative in the sense that like at least they aim to make like the liquidity providers. If you're providing liquidity, you should perform like roughly the same versus like traditional markets are very PVP on the market maker or liquidity provider side. You know, the best market makers make a fortune, just insanely high returns, and like just the marginal liquidity provider, you're gonna burn money very, very quick. So yeah, I think like that's one thing, like from an AMM perspective, you kind of want to address like those PVP games.
Definitely. Yeah, I think the major thing of any AMM is really, how do you incentivize liquidity providers efficiently? And how do they actually make money? Because they are giving a lot of capital up front. And like, do the fees actually make them profit over X amount of time? Or are they really just excellent? So have you thought about these challenges and how to solve them?
Yeah, well, I mean, there may be two things in that question to address. You are right. Like the best market makers do make very high amounts of return, but that's largely because like if you actually look at like studies that have like looked at like order books in TradFi markets, and you say like our providers, people with like resting orders, actually like on net profitable to a large degree, they're actually not, like in aggregate. And the big reason being that like people who provide liquidity, like if you're a lot of this comes down to like queue games and like these PvP games, but if you're, you know, if you're one of the best market makers, if you're Citadel, you're probably like your quotes are a lot better positioned, usually because they're in the front of the queue and all that other stuff, and other people are not. So I think one thing people think is like order books are like automatically more profitable for liquidity providers when they're not. They're more profitable for a subset of them. But anyway, that being said, for AMMs in general, I think the way we think about it is that liquidity is a product, and it's a product whose fair market price is highly variable, either over time or depending on who's accessing that liquidity. I think AMMs have been very kind of dumb up to this point. If you have one pool, maybe you have multiple fee tiers and Uniswap, but liquidity isn't automatically moved between them. So as long as liquidity is resting somewhere, the cost to access that liquidity is the same regardless. I feel like equivalent of like full range XYK versus concentrated liquidity. That's like the simplest thing you could do. And that's great for version one of something, but that leaves a lot of money on the table. If you are selling something with highly volatile market price, you want to price it based on the market. Ideally, the perfect system would be like every time someone comes to trade, you would know how much is this liquidity worth? What are you willing to pay for it? You could just read their mind and then charge them almost as much as they're willing to pay for it. Now, obviously, like an imaginary fantasy, but you can get to a world where you can do a lot better, get closer to that. Obviously, when markets are volatile, the price of liquidity should be higher. Like demand for that liquidity is higher. People want to access it. Depending on who's accessing liquidity, the price should be higher or lower. If you're, for example, the MetaMask order flow is coming from like the MetaMask swap router, someone's paying like 100 basis points to do a swap, that person has like no information, right? Like they're not like some arbitrage trader who's like very, very sensitive to like, right? So like you can, right, if you're competing with that order flow, right, you can charge them less and vice versa. If you think like someone's an arbitrage trader, and it's like harder to do, but like if you think they're an arbitrage trader, right, you want to basically charge them about the value of the arbitrage that they're taking. So that's like kind of how we think about it, right? Like the key is like you have to just price liquidity more intelligently.
Yeah, definitely. You do have three different types of liquidity pools, I believe, that are all in the same liquidity pool. And these are, you know, the B-free one, the ambient one, and then also the knockout liquidity. I've never heard of the knockout. Let's go through each one of these and why you've combined them all together and the advantages of that over traditional AMMs or what other people have done.
Sure. Yeah. I'll start with the simplest kind. The ambient liquidity is the traditional XYK V2 style liquidity, full range. That's also auto compounding. Same thing, it's fungible, so you can wrap it in like LP tokens, do kind of all the stuff that's kind of difficult to do. Yeah. Even with full range liquidity on V3, that's like actually very difficult to wrap things in LP tokens because like the fees like sit in the side pocket. We have the V3 style liquidity, which is equivalent to like uni V3 liquidity concentrated based on a fixed range. And that's also the one difference there being is that the way we handle the fees. So uni V3 actually handles the fees. They're collected, they sit in the side pocket, they don't do anything. The way we actually handle fees is the fees get reincorporated back into the pool as ambient or V2 liquidity. And so instead of having like a claim to like a fixed amount of fees on the side, and because every pool is two-sided, right? You have two sides to that. You have just like this other liquidity pair. So one advantage of that is like things auto compound, not at like the same leverage you get on V3, but they still auto compound somewhat. That makes it easier if you have two V3 orders that are in the same range. You can also wrap those in fungible LP tokens in a way that's very impractical to do in Uni V3. So that's especially useful for like stable.
The fees are basically turning into like new LP.
Yeah, so it also increases liquidity in the pool. And that's actually why you put those in the same pool as well, because if you did those in two separate pools, what would happen is you might just have a V2 pool that hardly has any liquidity and never gets routed to. Maybe it's like a meme coin and it's mostly locked liquidity and you want to make a V3 position when it's a separate pool because there's a cost to route to multiple pools. Even in a low gas environment, you might just never get routed to. So having from a swapper's perspective, it's a single swap and it's seamless. And so there's not this routing issue. So that's why you combine them in the same pool. And then the third type of liquidity, knockout liquidity, which is just our term for it. Basically, that is V3 style. It's very similar to V3 style liquidity. The caveat being it has to be on a fixed range, fixed width, unlike V3 where it can be different widths. It has to be on a fixed width. Usually the pool's like 4 basis points or something. So it looks a lot like a limit order in terms of it's very thin. And then if the price in the pool ever moves outside that order, what happens? The position automatically locks in. It gets removed from the pool. So they behave like limit orders in that sense. So if you just want like a standing, you think ETH, if ETH ever dips to 2,800, you want to buy. So you might put in like a knockout order from like right around 2,800. Like again, it's like 4 basis points. So it'd be like maybe 2,799.95 to like 2,800.03 or whatever, right? And so if the price ever moves down to that price and ever moves outside of that, you get pulled out, which means that your USDC converts to ETH and now you've locked in your position. The problem with Uni V3 trying to do this is it doesn't work on the way back up. So you will, like if you do this in a traditional Uni V3 system, you will buy at 2,800, but kind of the whole reason you're doing that is because you think the dip will be temporary. You think Ethereum's underpriced, that it can go back up. So you can put in a range order at like right around there and it might go to like whatever, 2750, and okay, now you got ETH, but once it goes back up to 3,000, now you got USDC again. So that's not great. You don't have like that limit order type functionality in Uni V3, and you do have that in ambient. And the cool part is, right, like this is not dependent on any sort of off-chain system to like enforce that's inside the curve. So it makes the system more resilient also to like sandwich attacks and things like that, because even if this is all done in like a single bundle or transaction or whatever, from the sandwicher's perspective, if as long as there are a number of knockout orders in the curve, if liquidity may be available on the way down, but not available on the way back up, which is a lot of times what like sandwich mev packers are relying on.
There is the narrative of order books as well, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on like order books in crypto versus AMMs and the combination of them or the separation of them and the future of it, of this narrative?
Yeah. So I have a couple of thoughts. I think the major advantage, trading firms are very familiar with order books. So yeah. If, you know, any HFT quant knows how to trade in an order book, knows how to provide a lot of liquidity, is very comfortable for that. I think for major tokens, it's a good way to onboard a lot of liquidity very quickly, especially if you can incentives on top of the order book, then that's awesome. Yeah. It's hard to make money being a market maker, but if I can scratch or even lose a little bit of money and then make money on token emissions, that's very easy to onboard market makers. So I do think that's why you see order book DEXs that get a lot of people very quickly. So that's good. What's, I think, very hard to do in a decentralized context, or what people think is like order books solve MEV, they don't at all. The problem with MEV is like the fact that you have a block builder or have some entity that can like has some advantage, like rearranging transactions, either putting its transactions first because it has an arbitrage, or putting its transactions immediately after a trade, and or sandwiching even. You don't have that in like a traditional centralized exchange, or at least you don't know if centralized exchange isn't corrupt, which hopefully it isn't, because there's an exchange gateway, and the gateway makes sure orders come in atomically, and like the really good exchanges even have like atomic clocks sitting on every network card that someone's connected to, and as soon as they see your packet, it gets like timestamped down to the nanosecond and makes sure everything's like processed exactly in line. So certainly what couldn't happen at like somewhere like the CME or like a real exchange is like someone could not see your order coming in and then like trade in front of you or something like that. So the problem is with DEXs, that's not true, or at least right, like in a blockchain context, there's a block builder, and the block builder can do all kinds of stuff. But like in particular, like what they can do is the same problem you see with like LPs is that like LPs lose to IL because you have like searchers like Beaver will look at the price of Binance, the price of Ethereum is a lot slower, and then arbitrage, and then the LP providers get kind of wrecked on that because like they're trading at a bad price almost by definition. But if you have an order book on Solana, the same thing can happen. Like Solana block time is 400 milliseconds. That's an eternity compared to like a centralized exchange matching engine. There's no reason, right? Like the same can happen on Solana where someone can watch the price of Binance, and if it's an order book, okay, you just slam the bids or the offers on the DEX order book, and then the LPs are going to bleed money, and either they have to widen out to make up for that, or they lose money, or you have to incentivize them. And I don't think it's been a huge problem in Solana yet, just because like Solana volume has kind of just recently taken off, and maybe there's more like a technical curve to do it. But like from a fundamental level, there's nothing about order books to solve.
What about combining order books with AMMs?
Yeah, that's a okay. So like in some sense, like I guess I shouldn't say that's a bad idea, because like we do have like limit orders and or like quasi limit orders. So like I don't want to say like we're doing a bad thing here, but so like the main thing with that, like that concerns me, is that order market makers can place liquidity at like very thin levels, like points, and then they can also go front and they can cancel. And going back to kind of what I said before is like market makers are very PV, so they want to like they want to extract like super normal returns. Like I think the reality is like Citadel will never be happy with, like, even if you make the best AMMs and they're like super the fees are like super responsive and like everything, right? I mean, like outside like token emissions and stuff, which are long term, you can't do forever, but like we make the best AMMs, I don't think the yields on those after like IL are going to be like higher than 20% in equilibrium, which is still like a great return for the average person. But like Citadel does not want a 20% return. Certainly Citadel Securities, like the market maker group, it's not, they like nothing to them, right? They do not want to like put their capital for that, right? So if they're going to be a market maker in a hybrid market like that, they're going to demand really high returns. And at the end of the day, like those returns have to come from somewhere, and they're probably going to come out of the pocket of the passive LPs. So I think that's like why I think maybe that model the best. And like one thing at Ambient we always try to do is like we don't think there should really be like actors in the system who are like privileged and earning like super high returns. Like we think like the cooperative nature of AMM is actually a very important property.
As in like how would they cooperate?
Well, I guess they cooperate in the sense that like in a traditional like FOB where you're based on like first in, first out, like price time priority, right? Like most FOBs operate in price time priority. When if you and I are both market makers at the CME, like the S&P 500 index futures, which is maybe one of the most liquid instruments in the world, when we're market makers, one of the most important things we're fighting about is like who gets time priority. Like HFTs are so sensitive down to nanosecond. It's not because like the ability to trade at that precision is like anything fundamental to the market, but because I want to make sure if you and I are putting in an order at the same price that my order goes in before yours, which means my order is resting in the book before yours, which means if another order comes in, I get matched first, which is actually super, super important in terms of just being, because when you're at the front of the queue, you're mostly interacting with small orders that are coming in. And when you're at the back of the quote unquote queue, meaning here like the list of orders that are in line to trade at a certain price, when you're at the back of the queue, you're mostly interacting with large orders that are moving the market. And those are like exactly the type of orders you don't want to be interacting with. You get on the wrong side of when the market's really moving. So order books are very key, like in that sense, where it is possible for certain participants from even very small ledges, like 100 nanoseconds here and there, who has like a faster FPGAs, to earn like very, very outsized returns. But like certain market makers earn very outsized returns. In AMMs, yeah, besides like, you know, tricks like that, like isn't really possible because like when a swap interacts with a pool, there's like an entire pool of liquidity. So unlike that system where you and I are both market makers, you get all the order and I get none. If we're both LPs in the pool and you're 50%, I'm 50%. We mostly are like, we share, right? Like we get half the flow, half the fees. And so it's kind of like pro rata and divided like that, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I think like a big challenge, I don't even know if it's really a challenge, but you know, all these different, the variety of AMMs and they're all using the same tokens like ETH and then token A, and they're all on different chain. I mean, well, different chains, but also different AMMs. It just seems like the fragmentation of liquidity is also quite shit. And I don't know if anyone's like built a solution to actually like combine them all together. I actually think Composable Finance is doing that, but maybe I'm. Yeah, I think they just released a white paper as well. But I guess like the alternative would be like a router and then doing a trade based on all these AMMs on different, I guess you could do chains as well, and that's what they're doing, but like different AMMs in general on the same chain. I guess that's a router and that's how you solve it. But without the router, why not just have like one conglomerate of all of the LPs in one spot instead of creating the new DEX?
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. I think like most times liquidity, at least within a single chain, tends to concentrate over time, right? Like if you look at like Uniswap's market share over time has mostly coalesced. Hopefully they'll stop coalescing and we'll start eating into some of their market share. But in general, especially like stable, there's like Curve still do like stable pairs. Yeah. But if you look at like non-stable pairs, actually like Uni has a very dominant monopoly right now. Between chains is really interesting, right? Because you can't do that like atomically. So it's always like, it's tricky, right? Because like it also goes back to like, okay, you can show a price to a user, but like, the entire point of like a blockchain or consensus is that like I can operate atomically within the realm of consensus. So when you have a bunch of L2s, you can't really do that, or maybe you can if you have a shared sequencer, but like it's not trivial. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like ETH has some issues, unfortunately. Like I think like the long term vision makes sense, like separate out consensus from like execution. But like this is like kind of a segue. But I like 3 years ago when we started, like ETH was the obvious choice, right? Like you're gonna build something, just build it on ETH. Like that's the default choice. You don't have to really think about it. And now like we spend all of our time just thinking about, well, like mainnet's not really active, so we have to figure out which L2 do we go on, like which one's growing, which one's... It's almost like the same, like if you were an alt L1 project 3 years ago, like all you spend your time thinking about is ecosystem stuff. And now if you're an ETH, you spend all your time thinking about like ecosystem stuff. So like it kind of sucks. Like in some sense, like Solana is almost like the default choice now.
When migrates a Sol.
Exactly.
Yeah, it seems like all the shitcoins is on like Base and Sol. Not really... Even.
Yeah, it's been interesting, and like we've tried to figure that out because we're not on either of them, at least not yet. But it's been interesting, like we've thought about that a lot. Like obviously as a DEX, like we would love to have like shitcoin activity, but like how could we bootstrap like shitcoin ecosystem on this chain?
Yeah
it's interesting. I don't know exactly like how do you do it.
Yeah, it seems like a big problem with all the new AMMs that spin up. Whether it doesn't matter if their technology is better than someone else's, because Uniswap, you know, despite being inefficient with the V3 in terms of, you know, JIT and people just being exit liquidity, they still have like a large share of market, and it contributes to, I guess, like first mover advantage. But something like, the question is always, how do you get someone else's market share?
I mean, it's tough, right? It's something I really underestimated going into it, was just like, okay, you can have like a great model, you can have great tech, but people don't want to rewrite code to like
do. Yeah, they basically just don't care.
And yeah, just, like, okay, Uni V2 works. I have this Uni router or Liquidity Vault or this Liquidity Locker, and it works with Uni V2. Like, because even it's funny, like, Uni V3 is open source now. Like, it wasn't for a while, but like,
yeah,
you can fork it. But like, even on a lot of chains, the activity is just Uni V2 if you really look at it. But yeah, I mean, like, for us, it's been like a kind of a Windows type issue, is that we're not a Uniswap fork. So we'll never be exactly like bytecode compatible. We are putting like a lot of effort now into like, okay, can we show like interfaces that like basically look identical to Uni? And yeah, I mean, so that's one aspect of it. And like getting on stuff like indexing sites like Dex Screener and stuff is like a challenge, right? Because they're just designed to work with like Uni forks. So like, obviously, you know, there's like this whole ecosystem of like compatibility stuff that's hard to break through. I don't know. Like, it's also weird because like coins operate under very different calculus than like, I guess, like a market like Microsoft or like NASDAQ, right? Like, people really are not very price sensitive coins. They don't care if like the fees you're able to like, oh, do all this stuff, and like, yeah, the swap fees are lower. Nobody cares. They're punting companies like 10x.
Yeah.
Yeah.
50% slippage.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. It's been interesting. I think like shitcoins probably are here to stay. So like, we're trying to beef up our presence there.
Like, a pivotal moment in DeFi in terms of AMMs was SushiSwap. You know, to incentivize the LPs, they would create, you know, these reward tokens and distribute that for actually staking into a pool. I think that was like phenomenal. And that was like probably one of the best, well, I guess, moment that kicked off an entire bull run, actually.
I think they did that really, like, not just because of like, okay, people obviously love getting rewards and stuff, as well, like, made people, well, a couple, number one, like, when stuff's composable, you can do really cool stuff like that. And like, AMMs are really interesting too, because like, liquidity is a thing, right? If you're a liquidity provider, like in an order book, like, oh, I'm providing, you know, Citadel provides, you know, you say, oh, Citadel or like James Street or whoever provides liquidity, like Microsoft stuff, but what does that really mean, right? Like, okay, they're quoting at the bid and the ask, and like at a certain, it's like a conceptual thing, right? Like, at some point, right? Like, it's not like something you can touch. And AMM's really cool, right? Like, I'm providing liquidity, like, there's an LP token. So I can actually go literally take that liquidity and like go trade the liquidity itself or borrow against the liquidity itself. So like, that's just a really cool concept for AMMs in general.
The question is always, how do you incentivize people to use your product? And MasterHip was phenomenal because of the rewards. And I guess Pickle did kind of the same thing. Pickle Finance.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the next one is, because you can have great tech, but
people do probably need to like get some incentives. Like, the reality is like untrusted technology, right? Like, those early, if you have anything that has like network effects, like early users add a tremendous amount of value to the network. So like, it's kind of logical that they should be like getting some of that value back.
Yeah, definitely. In some way. It always comes down to the fees if you're LP. I mean, it's a difficult problem.
Yeah, but I would say I was probably, just because of my age and when I went to college, I was probably one of the first 10,000 users on Facebook. One of the very early users of Facebook, right when they were rolling out to colleges. I always feel like Facebook probably should have paid you something for bootstrapping their networks. I wish tokens existed back then.
So yeah, I guess when you use that, how did you see that grow? Why were people using that over something like MySpace?
I think Facebook was interesting because they were originally just Harvard, and then they were originally just a few other schools, and they would roll out very slowly from school to school. So I think people liked it, actually. Like, now everyone thinks like Facebook's like a boomer site and like your grandparents are on it and stuff. But actually, it was kind of the opposite. It was more like Snap or like TikTok or something, where it was just college kids. So you could kind of goof around on there. It was also like you had to have a campus address to log in and stuff. And then they did very good with this FOMO thing, where it's like, okay, Facebook's coming to our campus, like, finally, like, people would sign up and mess. But yeah. Yeah, why not MySpace? That's a good question.
Exactly. It's always the incentives. You could make like a good narrative for yours, even follow the latest trend and try and cater to that. Yeah, I love the MasterChef system, but that ended up dying as well, but it was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Why didn't Sushi hold on to all that market share that
he got? It just went back to Uni later on.
Yeah, that's harder for me. Like, I don't know. Like, what did... I guess V3 came out and then that. But I think it was trending back to Uni quite a bit, even before V3, but yeah, Sushi and Lumini V2 were pretty much identical.
Yeah. 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 They just had the rewards and Uni didn't. I think honestly that game was more of a, you know, jump around MasterChef to MasterChef and like snipe.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
Because then people just started forking it, and yeah, it was just the MEV wow. game at that point.
Yeah, it was interesting doing MEV. Like, that was probably the era when it was most active on MEV.
Those were
like
prime times.
You just see so many, like, what the hell is this deck? Or, I don't know, some of them are like so ridiculous. Whatever, swap. What the hell is this deck?
Yeah, it was fantastic times. I mean, it would have been fantastic to build a auto farm bot and like snipe the newest meme coin and just like provide instant liquidity and just farm it.
You would see, like, as soon as a coin would launch somewhere, it'd be like the whole block would just be filled with like all these different coins, and you're like, I don't even know where I'd place my swap in this. But if you did it right, like, it was just like the amounts we made were like crazy.
Do you use any like routing mechanism for, let's say someone wanted to do a multi-hop swap? Maybe even there was someone did a swap, right, and you're doing an arbitrage. Maybe you could incorporate that. I don't know. Maybe it's not worth it.
Yeah. I mean, we're pretty... So, like, the single pool thing helps. So, like, technically, actually, we do support, like, an arbitrary number of pools per pair. Right now, we're just running with, like, one canonical pool per pair. But, like, we do have hooks and, like, all the stuff, like, for Unity 4. And, like, those would be, like, different pools per pair. But mostly our routing's pretty simple. Like, mostly what we found was like everything kind of runs through ETH. So like,
yeah,
sometimes you get like weird routes, but like it's very rare where we have like a pool that's really liquid that's not like ETH, one of the sides of the pair. So mostly things are just like running through the ETH pair, basically.
Do you ever do like a rebalancing mechanism as well, or try to arbitrage our own
pools?
Yeah, like if someone does a giant trade, would you ever that arbitrage back to the user?
Luckily, we had a number of traders that integrated us pretty early, and were able, I guess we could have made money just running that ourselves, but probably be a distraction from building the product. But yeah, luckily we're actually pretty efficient on that. We had a number of like searchers that integrated us early, and that stuff mostly gets handled like pretty much.
Yeah. If you're thinking about incentives, maybe that is one where you actually capture the arbitrage and pay it back.
Yeah. Yeah. We've thought about that quite a bit, actually, going back to it, like setting different fees per trader. And one thing I think is interesting with AMMs is, like I mentioned, right? Okay. Like, it's cooperative between liquidity providers in the pool, but ultimately I think it should actually be cooperative with liquidity takers as well. And like, what I mean by that is like, most markets is this war between providers and takers, where like the providers are trying to rip off the takers as much as possible, or the takers are trying to rip off the providers, and the providers are setting very high fees to make up for that. But you know, like one thing like we think makes sense is that you can actually charge people different fees based on like how much they're paying back to the pool. And like you can look at like their behavior over time and get like a pretty good sense of that. So if someone is doing like that type of arbitrage and they're willing to, and we actually have a mechanism in our contracts where you can arbitrarily pay more to the pool than the base swap fee. No one knows better than the arbitrageur like how much it's worth to them. So if they're consistently paying like, let's say 80% to the pool, they can be trusted to the point where they can access like a very low base fee. And then like, you know, continue to access that, they have to, you know, over a 30-day aggregate period or something, pay a certain amount of their profits back to the pool. And then kind of everybody wins, right? Because like setting very high fees means like a lot of those trades don't get taken. Nobody makes any money. And vice versa, setting fees low mean like the arbitrageurs often make too much money and the LPs don't get paid. So like the ideal would be that like these arbitrageurs work directly with the protocol to remit that back. So yeah, I think that's a very interesting observation, something like we'd like to get incorporated.
Yeah. 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 It just comes down to rewards at the end of the day, because just to scale and take market share from Uni is like a very difficult problem. And
it's a very difficult problem.
More important than the tech.
Well, yeah. I mean, the tech helps, right? Like, I think at least the tech helps.
At the end of the day, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you have token emissions and those like, that's going to exit. Like, that's right. You have that, but like, those don't run forever.
Yeah.
Like, they're to onboard people. So, you need to onboard liquidity. And kind of the way to think about it is like, to get like, you need order flow. Because, yeah, like, that those are who are actually paying the swap fees. So, more like order flow you can get pointed at you, the more LPs get paid. And then it's just okay. Like, the amount of order flow you're getting and how much you're charging that order flow. And if you can do better than uni on those two things multiplied together, then you beat, you have a better thing for LPs and you get liquidity, and then hopefully you win. But it's not easy, right? Uni is very, very entrenched.
I think a lot of people have done like the kind of multi-product strategy where they do like a, you know, borrowing, lending, AMM, farming, like everything. But yeah, then that doesn't work. And so it's how do you incentivize it? Yeah, I guess it always just comes back to it.
It's just, yeah, it's tough, right? Like, yeah, there's something to be said for that. Like, okay, well, you're like a DeFi supermarket and like everything is in one place. And it is, yeah, it is like tempting to do that. But like each of those things are like big categories. And like you're tackling like four things at once. It's hard not to do like four things like half-assed versus just like focusing on one thing. But
imagine like, okay, you could borrow from your own pools as like flash loans. Well, I guess you do that with like flash swaps, but flash loans, even just lend, I mean, with lending from a...
You could do lending, like we've thought about that, where, because you do have a lot of capital just like sitting in, even with concentrated liquidity, like you still end up like, people don't set their ranges that tight.
Yeah.
So you do have that capital that's sitting there.
Well, even like having the option of shifting a V3 price range for, let's say, a giant swap that goes over multiple ticks, maybe someone that put it in a tick like super far back, you can actually adjust it for them so they get more.
Move them up.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's actually a cool idea.
And because like maybe they're just bad at like, you know, predicting where the fucking price is going to go. You do it for them automatically, and then that's a pretty good incentive for LP, I think.
Yeah, I like that. I think people do want, so like we've tried to make the application, like concentrated liquidity is not the simplest thing. Like the reality is like V2 liquidity is just like, concentrated liquidity is like confusing and annoying. And we've tried to make the application more intuitive for that. But yeah, I think like, I don't know why you haven't seen a ton of like liquidity management vaults take off for like V3 liquidity, but I think like that does make more sense. Like a lot of people are just going to like, here's my capital, let me put it in, please reasonably manage it.
Yeah.
To generate,
maybe they get a fee for being in it longer, or a better deal for being longer than shorter. I think there's a lot you can do there. Or like priority of how far is the tick away from the actual tick being executed.
Yeah, you could do that. One problem you run into with liquidity management vaults is that when you have a bunch of small users and they're rebalancing their position, like because they went out of range and they need to rebalance, they go from being liquidity providers to liquidity takers. Now they need to access liquidity to swap to get their balance back to get back in range. And like one thing that like I think wasn't even like a feature, like you could do that on like one click on Ambient and people really like that. But the problem with liquidity vaults is that all the liquidity's there. So there's no liquidity to like rebalance on the other side. So I think that once a liquidity vault becomes like 80% of the pool or something, it actually becomes unworkable in some sense. But yeah, I think you're right. The liquidity vault space, like V3 liquidity vaults, is really underexplored, especially in the sense of incentives around who's in there and priority and all that stuff.
Yeah, maybe the ticks are just like someone does a giant trade in one direction, or there's like 20% liquidity and just something that's not being utilized at all, because they're banking on something later on, but it's just never used for like, say, 90% of the time. It might just be better to shift it over for each trade. It might be more expensive, but at least they're getting more fees. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's also like stuff, at least on L2s, is getting cheaper. Like base is really cheap.
This is true. Yeah. But even scaling the fees with like how much liquidity is in there in that tick might be interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's something that you're right. You need more integration between the DEX and the vault. Yeah. Right, because you can have vaults, but they're like protocols built outside the DEX. And like they're hard to do. With hooks, there's actually interesting things you can do, right? Because like stuff gets triggered atomically inside the pool, and you can change the fees, you can change like different parameters. So yeah, there's like scope for integration between the vault and the AMM pool itself to interact in different ways.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of more incentives. So these seem like the main ones, like definitely the shifting of liquidity, maybe like combining liquidity from multiple AMMs, but that would just be a router thing. Because like if you don't want to step over a tick range, maybe another AMM is within that tick range.
That's true.
So you can like route it like that, and so it's not actually jumping out of it. And then like, yeah, like for more liquidity in one range, you could just
charge a higher fee because there's more liquidity.
Yeah. I mean, I think another thing, like on that point that hasn't really been explored, is that most AMMs, and including us here as well, like we're guilty of this too, they're trying to get as much liquidity as possible because, like, why wouldn't you? Obviously, you want your numbers to look better. But the reality is like, there's some amount of liquidity that's probably optimal relative to your order flow. You don't necessarily want more than that. Like, if I had $1 trillion of liquidity in like an ETH/USDC pool, it wouldn't be that healthy for the pool because there's just not enough order flow to support that. It'd just be a huge gift for arbitrage box. One thing that's interesting, like I guess Affinity has done this on Solana, but one thing that's interesting, I think, is maybe underexplored is pools where the total amount's capped, you know, at a certain amount relative to order flow, but there's some cap because beyond that, it's not healthy to have too much liquidity relative to the flow. There are lots of incentives you can work out there, like who's allowed.
Capped amount of liquidity, but then immediate flow would be like, what if one person just puts all their money into it? Which is fine. I guess that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I guess you don't want to turn away users, especially if you're like, right, like, I want people on the Insight, like, even if they're just using a dollar, trading a dollar, I want them, like, using our site and, like, getting used to.
If you can, like, convince people why having too much liquidity is actually an issue versus, like, low liquidity, maybe.
Yeah, low liquidity is bad, obviously. Like, you don't want to be able to swap something, but, like, high liquidity can also be unhealthy for the market.
But then how do you determine how much is too much?
It's a hard problem because, like, even you could observe over, like, kind of the way I think about it is, like, you have toxic flow and you have non-toxic flow, and, like, your non-toxic flow is, like, organic users, and your toxic flow is, like, mostly arbitrage traders, and your non-toxic flow is pretty much set.
Right.
Like, it's not going to grow beyond a certain layer. There's only so many organic users. Your toxic flow is, like, infinite. There's, like, maybe at one point, like, an arbitrage trader will get, like, hit it, but that's usually pretty high. And they can raise capital pretty easily. They have good returns. So, like, if you're giving an arbitrage, like, it's going to get arbed. So, like, the more liquidity you get, like, that skews the ratio of the percent of your order flow that's toxic. Just keeps increasing, which is...
So you got to screw them over by reducing liquidity.
Yeah. So the way I think about it is, like, what, you know, how, try to guess, like, how much non-toxic flow, like, organic demand there is, which, again, is not trivial, but at least it's, like, a framework to start thinking about it.
But wouldn't that mean there's, like, higher slippage for organic users if you're reducing?
There would. So, like, I think there's also a point where, like, if the organic users are getting higher slippage, then at that point, you're probably, like, too low, right? Like, you'd want to be big enough that, like, most average trades, like, you can accommodate without significant slippage. But yeah, that is, like, kind of a complex thing. And, you know, it's a similar problem to, like, what market makers in an order book face. Like, you quote, you have to size your order. And that's not an easy problem. Like, people spend their whole lives on that problem.
This is true. I imagine, like, it's like more liquidity, less slippage, but then you're not. I mean, is toxic flow really that bad if they're balancing the pools?
No, they're not. I don't think, like, an AMM toxic flow is that bad. But if you only have toxic flow in a pool, the pools are going to get balanced no matter what. But if you only have toxic flow in a pool, the yields are never going to be higher than what you're losing to, like, IL or whatever you want to call it, right? Because arbitrageurs are not in the business to lose money, right? So they're not going to pay more in swap than they're making from balancing the pool. So yeah, you're right. Like, that is actually kind of a way we think about it, is, like, toxic flow itself isn't bad. We'd like toxic flow to pay more money. Ideally, we'd like them to pay as much as they are able getting from the arbitrage trades, but, like, the pools do need to be balanced. And then the question becomes, how much, quote unquote, non-toxic flow, organic flow, can we get? And those traders do pay more in swap fees than they make moving the pool. And so if you want your pools to be profitable, you need to have a lot of, quote unquote, non-toxic flow relative to your SaaS.
But if you just increase the fees on, like, quote unquote, toxic flow, then...
That's easier said than done, though, in a blockchain. Because anyone can spin up a new address, right? Like, so it's, like, tough to tell.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess if they bundle up there, yeah, that makes sense, actually. The naive one was like, okay, check how many swaps they're doing in a... But that just becomes, like, a block builder problem.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of works, but, like, it's a tough game, right? Like, there are a couple ways to do it. Like, one is to give some credible commitment that you're not like an arbitrage trader. And like, what do I mean by that? Like most arbitrage traders have certain properties. The biggest one being is that they have very, very short time horizons. Like the price of Binance has moved to a certain point and like it's only going to be dislocated for, you know, probably one block at most. They don't trade now. So like one easy thing you could do is, hey, if a swapper comes in and is willing to wait two blocks or wait, you know, 30 seconds or, you know, either on chain or off chain. And again, it's easier said than done. But like if someone's willing to say, here's my trade. I'm willing to wait 30 seconds, then you can execute it. You can say, okay, that's great. Like, I can give you a lot lower fees because I know you're an organic user and it's profitable for me to trade with you at almost any price.
Do a reputation-based system.
Yeah, so. Reputation I think is huge. I think is probably the biggest way to solve it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it worked with Flashbots, why not AMMs?
Works with Flash, and like in some sense it works with TradFi. Too, like, why does Robinhood get better quotes from Citadel? Because Robinhood has a reputation. If they started sending, you know, algo flow through the Robinhood broker, Citadel would quickly be like, screw you guys and shut them off.
Hmm.
Or charge them more, at least.
Yeah. Well, man, I super hope that the ambient finance takes number one, kills the corn. Unicorn. Not kill it, but like, get upset. Take a little bit of pie, a little bit hungry here. We want some pie. So hopefully it all goes well and can find some rewards and kick off the new bull market so I'm not poor anymore. So.
thank you. Yeah, hopefully.
Waiting for the bull market. So please create it. No, but in all seriousness, thank you very much, Doug, for coming on and you know, explaining kind of the day in the life of someone running an AMM, the problems faced, challenges, etc. Very insightful.
Well, thanks for having me. I had a great conversation.
Likewise, sir. And for anyone wanting to use a DEX, go use Ambient Finance.
Yes, please.
He needs the fees, guys. Come on. Hey, man. Thank you so much for jumping on. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Until next time.